Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Poet Radio. It's the December 2022 edition. And my name is Chris Funkhauser, and my guest today on the program is Bert Kimmelman. Bert is a poet, he's a literary critic, and a professor. He's authored more than 10 collections of poetry, and last year published Visible at Dusk, an extensive series of essays. As an editor or co-editor, he's produced volumes focused on William Bronk, Michael Heller, Basil King, and most recently, George Quasha. He has written monographs on Bronk as well as literature in the Middle Ages. Bert and I have been colleagues at New Jersey Institute of Technology for more than 25 years, and it's a pleasure to finish up the year with him sharing poems and conversation on the program. Bert, to my mind, you've always been so productive. Why don't you tell us what you've been working on lately or what's happening with you?
Well, lately, I have a new collection of poems. So that's probably my latest tangible thing.
This is A Steeple at Sunrise?
Yes.
New poems. Bert's just given me a copy. It's a Marsh Hawk Press. So yes. What's the general story about the collection?
Well, it's a period, in a sense, it's periodic. That is to say, it's poems that are all brand new and written probably in the last 2 to 3 years prior to publication, which was the end of November of 22 this year.
Uh-huh. So these are pandemic poems?
At least half the book, in terms of page numbers, is a series, a pandemic series that I titled Plague Calendar. The other part of the book, which is the first part, is just individual poems that were written, some during the COVID, even though we're sort of still in COVID, maybe returning to some more masking than we've become accustomed to lately. But anyway, it may still be the pandemic, but the throes of the pandemic, particularly as it happened at the very start, you may recall that Westchester at one time was the epicenter. So the way it affected people in the northeastern part of the country particularly, but I mean the poems are basically personal, and I think talk about, let's say, personal feelings. There's nothing about in the poems. There's nothing aboutness, let's call it. It's really just percepts that are sometimes attached to thoughts, and they're published in the order they were created, even though sometimes I went back and I rewrote things or fixed, whatever. But I wanted them to be literally a document, a historical document to some extent. I don't want to make it sound like they have some great stature in terms of history or that it wasn't meant to be historiographical, but they were written like that. And they're to be taken as a group, even though some of them really do stand on their own. Some of them don't as much.
All right, that's good. I should have mentioned earlier, we were recording this session at Bert's house in Maplewood, New Jersey. Is this where you were during the lockdown?
Yes.
I'm sure.
Yeah. Yes.
So, okay.
Right.
It's good to be here. You want to read some of these poems?
Yeah, I could. I mean, I was thinking I'd start with the first poem in the book, which is not part of the plague calendar, but yeah. Sure, I could start with the plague. Start with the plague calendar.
Uh-huh. All right.
I'm going to go back to the beginning. I should say a little bit of framing of this, more than I have said already, kind of a setup. If there's one particular locale that's part of the poems and often mentioned, it would be a certain part of what is called the South Mountain Reservation, which is local to this part of northern New Jersey. In that reservation particularly, there's a place where there's a parapet. even though at a certain point, and especially the earlier COVID lockdown, all the state parks and a lot of the city parks, some of the local town parks were maybe still open, but there was this was a county park, South Mountain Reservation. That was off limits, as were the shore, the entire Jersey Shore, the golf courses, you name it. I mean, everything was on lockdown because who knew what back then. So there was a period where to try to get some relief, let's say, from the intensity or the oppressiveness of the lockdown, being at home, or, you know, it's one thing to take a walk around in the neighborhood that we live in Maplewood. It's a whole other thing to go to a park where there might be some birds. And the reservation was a little more wild than that, although it's pretty tame. So that was a great relief when I could do that sort of thing finally again. So anyway, the parapet becomes a kind of point of reference, and the speaker of the poems returns to that parapet a lot. But the poems aren't exclusively written from that particular place. They're poems of place, so that's important. Some of them, I mean, there are one or two poems written initially begun, and they're about take place at the Jersey Shore, for example, or some other places. But it had to do, they had to do with going and being able to calm down a bit from the oppressiveness that we were feeling.
So like being contemplative in nature type thing?
Maybe at times one got to be contemplative. I think the first thing that happened would be that my blood pressure went down or something. Oh. You know. So it was just kind of, wow, like, gee, I wonder, who am I here in this situation? You know, you forget this sense of emergency that we were all in at the time.
I don't forget, yeah, I remember.
Yeah. So anyway, that was the poems. I didn't mean at first to be writing something that eventually would be this longish series of short poems, but that's the way it turned out.
Well, that's a good introduction.
Yeah, as a setup, that's basically it. Maybe I should just read the first few and...
Yeah, please.
Okay, so the very first one, actually, I see it's dated, but it's just dated as 2020, rather than in a season or something like that. But the idea of place and dating is something that struck me very, very early in my poetic career, particularly when Paul Blackburn's book, his posthumous book, The Journals, came out. Blackburn was a mentor of mine, and I was like very young, so I was emulating people. But I was very struck by his poetics, still am. I think he's, in part because he died so young, that he's underrated. But that last book, The Journals, was a book that was literally set up as one journal entry after another. So that kind of documentation and the sense of place became very important to me too.
Ginsberg was also, and a lot of his poems are dated and located by name. So
uh-huh.
I think it's good practice.
Uh-huh.
Sure.
Yeah.
But this is just 2020. But the title of the first one has the month in it.
Oh, it has the month in it. That's right. Yeah. That's right. So it's Parapet, Late March. Now, these are short poems, I warn you. So.
No, that's fine. Why don't you take on as many as you care to read?
Okay. Parapet, Late March, which was in 2020. We look out past trees to a plain, river, harbor, its city jutting up, the sea beyond a gray sky. Start of spring. Naked branches reaching into a gray sky, I hear a bird call across a small valley, the same call from somewhere else once again. Parapet horizon. Above some treetops, the evening sky. I see its end, a spit of land. Trees reach up in early spring. The gray sky, drizzle. Trees reach up. New buds, not yet green. A bird squawks within, hidden from light. It's one note. Birds, early spring. A squawk, single note. Once again, I see you there, this bird, this tree. Well, here's one that was written after a day at the Jersey Shore when we finally were able to, we were allowed back there. So this is the summer of 2020. Sandy Hook Beach, September. So late summer, yeah. Sea, sand, casual gulls pick at one thing or another, their ruffled feathers in the wind, catching sun. And then the poem that follows that is back here in Maplewood. Late September. Awake, asleep, I hear the night's crickets. A lone bird, I rise in darkness. Welcome the faint early light. Late October at the parapet. This rainy Monday, gold and red trees, other trees already bare. I look through them for the first time. The gray sky. Birds barely chirp. No one here but me. Morning, late November. Plaintive crows dot the laced branches, arcs of bare trees over roofs, a gray sky. You could see, once the trees were denuded, if you were at the parapet, you could sort of see through them. They were slightly below the person on the parapet, but still, as the, if you were to look down and try to see through them, you couldn't in, let's say, late spring and summer. But as they were losing their leaves, you could see the town of South Orange, some you know, streets below it, below the parapet there. Of course, the parapet was on an edge of the reservation.
Is it near Eagle Rock?
No, it's not Eagle Rock, really, which is another part of the reservation, or an adjacent reservation, actually. Someone was telling me that he and his fiance got engaged there, or maybe they had their marriage ceremony there.
It's a destination in the Oranges.
Yeah. Okay, December trees from the parapet. The trees are hardly there. Below a steep slope, houses, roads arrayed in afternoon sun, the consent of human life. And beyond them, a vague city in its upright insistence. Only then the trees' lacy modesties, their naked winter sleep coming into view. January trees from the parapet. Gray, bare branches upright. The sun glows through cloud, white snow rivulets along some trails below, as if a world is there beyond forest. Mid-February at the parapet. The snow bounds, binds us to our pact, stillness to catch us when we fall, white trees, forest, dark trunks to no end. So I'm going to skip ahead to the last two. And this is no longer 2020. This is like, you know, a year or two later. end of winter, early March. Sun through windows, white snow patches. The street, houses blare. Ponytail, pink running suit. Sneakers striding by. The trees in late May from the parapet. Still some white flowers among the leaves, though trees in their fullness, all there is. Their green insistence fills in. You cannot see through them or over them, the sky unknown. Green alone, what there is to know, remember. Towering over us, their abundance. The trees in their green have risen up. All we have made is gone.
Bert, it's great to hear you read these poems, and obviously there's things in them that are like part of a, well, there's a thread of trees and branches and gray skies, and that sort of captures the mood of a pandemic, I would say. So, and I can appreciate that, and every poet's offerings of a pandemic experience. Yeah. I'm always asking people during these programs, you know, mm-hmm. what their pandemic experience is like, and yours comes through very nicely in these poems. But something I was wanting to ask you about after, you know, I've read probably most of your books of poetry, and mm-hmm. to my mind, you're so productive, and these books are, you know, you're getting books out every other year or so since I've known you, I think, maybe, about that much.
Well, I've had a spurt lately, and that's definitely from the pandemic as well.
So I'm wondering, I have my own answer to this question, mm-hmm. and I think now that we've heard these poems, it's fair to bring this in, because people out there who aren't familiar with your work now have at least a sense of it. I was wondering, where do you see yourself fitting in to the literary world? I mean, I have my own sense from hearing these poems and knowing your poetry. In this century, you know, aside from, say, conceptualism and FLARF, there's not really a lot of naming going on, you know, in terms of, like, we used to have all different kinds of labels for, you know, the different areas of modernism. You name check, I think, in this book, just flipping through it quickly, I see Oppen's name.
There's an epigraph from Oppen.
Zukovsky.
Yeah.
So do you see yourself following through in a kind of objectivist tradition?
Yeah, well,
because, I mean, it seems like...
Tradition is definitely what you're talking about. In a sense, it's not something I chose. In fact, there's an essay, it's in an anthology now called Chapter One, which is a Marsh Hawk project. There's a version of it that is online, which Marsh Hawk has an online component called My Tutelage, which talks about how I first became exposed to poetry. So without like going into too much about the essay, a lot of it was accidental. And then it became inescapable to a certain extent. So for instance, I was in my later teens when I first started writing poetry. This was at a physical education major, I thought I would become a football coach, and I was an athlete. I wasn't particularly very scholarly, you know, I was never a good student until much later in life. And by coincidence, I was at this state college in upstate New York. There was a professor there, Shakespearean. He ran a creative writing workshop on Friday nights. And that I started attending that workshop and then started having certain friendships that came out of that. And I wasn't the only one who was a physical education major who ended up being a writer or an artist or whatever. This was something that happened because this school, which was a very well-known phys ed school, would recruit, and they would look for students, they were happy to take students who academically weren't doing particularly great, but they had, I mean, you had to go there from high school, you had to go there for a long weekend of all kinds of physical tests and skills and interviews and all kinds of things like that. Oh. So there were several of us. The best known of them now is the writer and poet Michael Stevens, M.G. Stevens, Steffens. But there were others. So I was kind of one of those and was totally raw. And this professor, by coincidence, his brother worked in a print shop in Greenwich Village, and he worked alongside Joel Oppenheimer, the poet Joel Oppenheimer. Uh-huh. And through Joel, who became a mentor, Joel would come to Cortland, and he would read, he would run a workshop. You know, we had these guest people to run workshops. And virtually everyone who are now thought of as part of what's called the Black Mountain School from Black Mountain College, virtually all of them came to Cortland, and I got to know them. They all read and they all ran workshops. You mentioned Allen Ginsberg, and that's where I first knew him. Gregory Corso, people who are not that well known necessarily now, but a lot of, you know, people who ended up becoming well known. But not so much Allen, but the poetics of the Black Mountain people. Robert Creeley became very important figure for me, and we were in touch for years. Charles Olson. So they had developed, let's call it a poetics on their own, and there were reasons why that came about. Part of it, though, was everybody being involved at Black Mountain College, where Olson was the rector, the last rector there. And so what I first learned, I mean, the reason I started writing poetry is because I had to take a required course, and all of a sudden I was reading John Donne or George Herbert or, you know, Wallace Stevens, of course, I thought was reading on my own. And so I just was, you know, fell in love with poetry. But when I first started trying to write it and think about it in that way, it was Black Mountain poetics. And that, so my first exposure really was to that way of understanding poetry. And so I wryly in this essay sort of say, so that I'm kind of like handicapped in a way, because I always see everything through the lens of the Black Mountain people principally, but Black Mountain was in part heavily influenced by the Objectivists. I knew Sid Corman well, who was somebody who had one leg in each camp, so to speak. And so that became very important to me. Right. But there were others, you know, who don't fit into that mold. William Bronk, as you mentioned, I knew him from my late adolescence on, and where we were friends and a lot of correspondence and in later years visiting and things like that. You mentioned Susan Howe, I think, before we got started, and that's quite a story about this essay I wrote on Susan Howe and William Bronk and Thoreau and New England. But yeah, so I mean, Bronk didn't want to see himself as part of what was going on at Black Mountain, even though probably the best endorsement blurb that he ever got was from Charles Olson. Bronk always said that he couldn't read Olson. He didn't know what the heck he was doing. But Olson understood Bronk and understood his, you know, how vital and important he was. So anyway, that's how I in a sense, I didn't pick it. It picked me in terms of influence or sets of influence. Right. You know, language poetry, I first met Charles Bernstein and Andrew. Bruce Andrews. Like in the early, mid-80s, like around 83, 84, something in the 84, I think it was.
But the language poets aren't much of an influence. They're more of a, just a...
Right, that's what I was going to say. Right, but right. As I came to learn more and be exposed more to it, I understood how Objectivists spread in many directions in terms of their influence.
True, that's true.
Of course, everybody read Pound and Williams and H.D. And Williams, I'm so often associated with Williams, it comes up on my Wikipedia page. I didn't put that there, you know.
It's a northern New Jersey, you know.
Well, that too.
Representation.
That too.
Yeah. But it's interesting to me because when I first began to get to know you, you were publishing a book on medieval literature.
Yeah.
Right? And so when you turned to academia somewhat late in the process,
yes.
Right? You have more of a bohemian yes. period and then yes. somehow found your way to the academy. So why, if you knew these figures, Blackburn, Oppenheimer, et cetera, how did you get from there to medieval studies?
Yeah, well, I did have that bohemian period. I had not finished college. I was one of a certain age where the thing to do, you know, Timothy Leary said, turn on, tune in, and drop out. I said, yeah, okay, that's exactly what I'm going to do. And I believed in it. And so I had a period that was eventually, I stopped writing, and then I even stopped reading poetry. And I sort of became lost to the literary world. I hadn't finished college. And many years later, it was like 14 years after I had dropped out, you know, late 60s, that I had an opportunity to get back to college because I realized how important it would be to get that bachelor's degree at the very least. And so I had a job that accommodated that. So I was able to get back to college, and it was there that certain professors sort of said to me, you know, you really should think about getting a PhD in English literature or, you know, whatever. I didn't know anything about that, but they led me in a certain direction, and they wrote letters for me eventually and things like that. So I ended up at the CUNY Graduate Center, and I was interested in I was starting to write poetry again and interested in going back to that, and I thought that the way to make a living would be to get an academic job, and then I'd be able to write poetry. But I fell in love with scholarship while I was in graduate school, and I also fell in love with medieval literature. I had had a Chaucer course as an undergraduate when I went back. I went back and finished up at Hunter College. That's not where I started, but anyway. And then went on to the Graduate Center the following year. And medievalism was just the most, I mean, medieval writers and the whole, I don't mean the historic, from a historical point of view so much as the ambiance and the feel of medieval writings, whether it was philosophical, theological, philosophical, or artful, you know, like poetry. I loved all that. I loved the languages. And eventually I was going to write a dissertation that would talk about three people. It ended up being an article. Three people who were, Paul Blackburn was one, and Diane de Prima was another, and George Ekonomou was the third, who were people who were doing contemporary writing in poetry, writing poetry, but they were medievalists in one way or another. Blackburn's translations of Père Vidal and other troubadours, important. Right. And obviously to Pound. By the way, one of the delights that I found many years later was I got the correspondence between Pound and Blackburn. It's like brilliant. It's a body of work that is its own literary document, you know. And I interviewed Diane for this thing and George, you know, Ekonomou. So I was going to write that. And then the summer that I had set up to really sit down and get it going, I decided, well, let me just do a warm-up. Let me just do an introduction to this whole thing about the Middle Ages, and then we can go into how these people were both serious medieval readers of medieval work, translators, what have you, and at the same time they were doing something very contemporary. And then I never got to the rest of, I never got to them. It became its own book, The Poetics of Authorship in the Later Middle Ages, which is still being cited.
Yeah, great.
Came out originally in 96.
It surprised me that when you published that book, because I've known you, you were, I think, editing a poetry magazine, Poetry New York.
Poetry New York, and that's right.
Yeah, I knew you as a contemporary figure who, you know, by that time we had met. And then I was like, wait, Kimmelman's publishing a book?
Yeah, the first time I saw you was at a conference at Stevens, I think it was, which was totally contemporary.
Yeah.
You know? So anyway, it was a book that I was able to get published. You know, I was trying at that point to get on a tenure track and get tenure somewhere, and it was a book that was publishable. So, and I was able to publish it, and my book on William Bronk came out shortly thereafter.
The Winter Mind?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I was able to get a publisher for that.
So you're a card-carrying academic credential.
Card-carrying.
Right. So let me ask, and maybe this can lead into reading some more poems. What sort of influence, if any, did these connections have on you, or did they still have or not have or anything? I mean, did the interest and influence of objectivism take hold? And, you know, I don't see,
well,
you know,
just to say about Bronk, Bronk didn't want, it was very important to him that he not be first of all, he had contempt for some of the Black Mountain poetry, that kind of thing. But he and Sid Corman were close. The very first book on Bronk was written by Sid Corman. And that kind of caused a rift between them, actually. But nevertheless, I saw in his style, let's call it, that there was this incredible precision, a sharpness which reminded me so much of the Pound Williams HD tradition and Black Mountain tradition, a little less so than the objectivist, but nevertheless, Bronk kind of does fit in a way. But Bronk, especially since I first came to know him when I was so impressionable, I was still in my teens, Bronk is just kind of a, you know, huge influence.
Right. And to that, and that has sustained itself.
Yes, it has. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But then I sort of was able to go in a direction that I had, in a sense, been prepared for, which is to write things that were more about what we, let's call it, objectivist or Black Mountain and language poetry. I mean, I think in terms of our cultural history, probably one of the great moments, although most people don't see it like that necessarily, but I think a great moment is the first issue of this magazine getting published, and the very fact that Barrett Watton and Robert Grenier decided to call the magazine this.
Yeah, you write about that in The Visible at Dusk.
Uh-huh.
I think a little bit.
Could be, yeah.
Well, that was a nice confluence, and they were in Gloucester somewhere up there in Cape Ann, weren't they? I mean,
yeah.
Some obscure location.
Uh-huh.
But yet that network was certainly provoked much dialogue and, you know.
It was the idea that goes back to Williams, really. You know, Williams, who is sometimes seen as an objectivist and certainly socially and otherwise was very involved with the original objectivist.
Yeah, yeah.
But it goes back to Williams's Machine Made of Words. So the pronoun is not just a minor figure or character in the sentence for somebody who understands a machine made of words. And, you know, like something that I picked up from my eventual doctoral advisor, who was such an incredible reader and brilliant translator. And his poems were okay. I mean, they were really, really skilled, but they seemed to be of another era. Well, Alan Mandelbaum was my advisor, particularly a great translator, but a great mind. He was the one that pointed out that Red Wheelbarrow, that putting an a preposition on a line by itself wasn't bad. No one would do such a thing, but Williams did that.
Yeah,
and Williams knew what he was doing.
So can we turn to some poems that yes. you see that might fall
well, let
into
me,
the...
Let me read from this same book, and then maybe I go to something else. But this is the poem that begins this collection, Steeple at Sunrise, which I think is really one of my best. It's not the parapet or anymore or anything like that. It's the city now. It's called July Morning San Giovanni. San Giovanni is a neighborhood in Rome. Everyone is up before the heat. Last night we climbed on our bus where Caesar fell. Pillars jutting up in the square. People trying to get home for the evening. Love is an assassination in the dark. Somebody picks at the morning's bottles, one by one. From his window, a naked man looks down, his roof of peach trees, TV dishes, gulls screeching. Motorcycles, cars, yellows, reds, veer through the city's ruins. So, maybe that's enough of that book. I could take a jarring turn and go back to early poems that came out as a book first in 1992.
That's fine to me, it's particularly if it's relevant to what we've just been talking
about. Well, I don't
about.
Know. I don't know. But they suggest where I was coming from.
Uh-huh, great.
That's not when I first was writing poetry, but at least in my new and selected poems, that's as far back as I went. These were poems of the 80s, mostly. Okay, so let me start there, just to get a contrast, if nothing else.
Just from the looking over the table here,
yeah.
I can tell that there is a contrast in those poems, because there's the longer, there's more,
yes.
They're more stanzaic.
Yeah. No, in fact, I was trying to really have very long lines.
Yeah, great.
Which, it's a failed experiment for me, but...
Who knows,
right. So this is, my first book came initially from my first trip to Paris. And, if you're a tourist, you end up going to museums. So I started writing about art a lot, and still do.
Yeah, you do. Yeah,
Ekphrastic, yes, for sure. So like a lot of these poems in this first book, which was called Mosaics, come out of that, that's what they're like. So this one, this first one is called Tate Gallery. And also after Paris, I went to London for a week. And when I was at the Tate at that time, the old Tate, I believe it was, there's this very famous bust by a sculptor that Ezra Pound was very keen on called Gordier Briesco, was
sure.
The last name. And so he's got a bust of Pound called the Hieratic Head. So I saw it in 86 standing there, being shown there in the Tate. So this is what that poem is about. His eyes look at no one, and looking, we turn away from the broken, the human passion, to form in a sublime dream, unreal, apex in some space somewhere. Whoever walks through the gallery's high marble archway sees his head, solitary and solemn, very center of the room and sky through windows. This is Gaudier's cold aspect, folded skull, at once Homeric rigor, though something still undone, and possibly dangerous. Is the mountainous forehead proud? Perhaps, yet in outright and unforgiving denial of tenderness, the imperfect, fallible, to find some remote idea, star, or other imagination. A shape of flesh covers the alien bone, and the seeming lower lip disappears. We might think bitten softly in contemplation between invisible teeth, and a hard jaw set thinking the impossible. We are unforgiven and denied. In our absolute terror, amazed at what arc crosses the absolute stars. There is a draft of sunlight. A hand passes along and over a heavenly shape. As it feels carefully, this hand finds mute stone.
It's still like in the objectivist tradition, but more kind of expansive with the, you know, the laying out of the details.
Well, if you want to think about the poems from like the COVID poems, there is such a restriction on anything that has to do with abstraction, ideas, anything.
Right.
Whereas here, I'm trying out like being able to really make some pronouncements and see if they work.
And that's sort of analytical in a way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes, definitely analytical. All right, so this was written. My brother Seth Kimmelman died of AIDS at the age of 40 in 1991, and this was written after my last visit with him when he was still alive. He was soon going to die, which he knew. I mean, everyone knew. And he took his own life, finally. He was one of these people who was a total control freak, got himself out of his deathbed to go to the funeral home the day before to make sure everything was right, what he wanted. He was an amazing pianist. He was a concert pianist. And he taught at New England Conservatory, anyway. So this is a poem called, from a painting by Franz Marc, called The Fate of the Animals, which was done in 1913. So the title of the poem is Franz Marc's The Fate of the Animals, 1913/Boston, 1991. Seth Kimmelman, 1951 and 1991. Among the dangerous shards, the breathing animal turns, nervous and bright, and looks into the dead wind. The act is simple, yet the world's structures abandoned to find a place in the wreckage, incalculably complex. You lie on your couch in your living room. Your useless spindle legs rest on my visitor's lap. What will become of us all, living and dead? You say it's not death's mystery, but the details of disaster, the new illnesses each day, which overwhelm, and the same tubes, their clear liquids, their unforgiving order. They are sleepless, without any musculature. They are here while you, incredibly, disappear before our eyes. Strange enough, there's no longer confusion. We speak softly, brother to brother now, of all the things we'll miss.
Pretty timeless, Bert.
Yeah. Here's another art poem, which actually is sort of looks ahead to what I end up doing later, because it's very short lines and very closer to being fragmented or something. And it's about Miro at the Guggenheim. It was written in 87. The hairline across the eye, the red sun, these are the creatures of the air who dance and cajole. These things are to be loved, sight to which we cling as precious filaments of the blue, enormous sky. So these are obviously ekphrastic, you know, poems. I'll just read one or two more then. Motherwell's Sepia Elegy, Museum of Modern Art. January 1988. Nothing is ever decided. He looks at her in the morning light where the hunger, the movement, is unmistakable. The bend of her hip and leg when she sits. That joining reminds him of the corner of her eye when she smiles. And this coming together happens only in light, how it scatters over the small rolls and ruts of skin. In its power to make visible, light will always be there, just as the skin perishes. Yet it's the skin, the soft skin, makes the light beautiful. He loves the thought of it this way, this touch of skin. What he so remarkably sees becomes the idea of warmth, light, this place where he is, nothing beyond it. Here, she says, he here, and she, after all, here. These any two things. After all, there's love, caress of flesh, touch of the cheek warm as light. Her hair, his hair, strokes of the brush crossing so.
Now, is that diagram in the book next to the poem? Is that?
Oh, it's not a diagram. This is an ink painting, drawing, whatever, by Basil King.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, the book, the cover of the book has this gorgeous painting, a canvas.
Yeah.
And then there are all these ink drawings that he did with his hands, you know.
You're reading from a collected poem.
This is, yeah, the new and selected, Gradually the World. All right, so one of my few love poems was from this era. So this is in May of 87. It's called Waiting for Diane at the Clay Show, Museum of Modern Art. If in this space there are two lines, let one be the wild happiness the edge measures. And if there are faces, we are their round eyes, or the hat, the foot, the finger, all the lighted extremities, there. If in the warm light we must be them, then we must be them. Let the O in OU mean we are here beyond any form. So it's obviously using clay, clay's artistry.
I want to protest, Bert. I think that you could say that someone could say, not you, but someone could say that, you know, you, a lot of your poems are love poems in an abstract sense, maybe, but I mean, you're so observant and purposefully observant, you know, as if this focus on the moment or in time is like a very devotion, a passion, or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I mean, that is something. I mentioned Paul Blackburn before. I didn't even realize at the time what a huge influence he was and was going to be on me. And I think that's where I first was just entranced by just sheer observation.
Right, right.
And then I remember being, this was in the 60s, visiting a poet who passed away many years ago now, Bradford Stark. And this was right after, I think, the material, Oppen's book, The Materials, had just come out. And he was reading, this is my first exposure to George Oppen's work. And Oppen is observant, not quite trying to be observant in the same way that Blackburn is, but I felt and saw that same thing, and I just, right. So compelling. Here's one from much later. This is from 2000, anyway, not much later, 2006, on one of Munch's paintings that he did in the late 1800s, called Despair. He is looking over the rail of the promenade, but he sees nothing, caught in the thought of the helpless. No, not even a thought. Despair itself, as undefined as the dark. Thick brushstrokes, the stabs of green paint below his blank face. people walk and talk together, out of earshot, making plans, while the red sky, its long, cloudless arcs, surges above blue hills hugging the sea, its ships making their way.
Wow, it's great hearing you read, Bert. I mean, due to pandemic and whatnot, I mean, poetry readings haven't been so abundant. So it's nice, it's nice to hear these.
It's a Zoom thing.
Yeah, that's true. Which was great, I thought, while it was happening. But we're getting close to the end here, but I felt it important to ask you about another aspect. I mean, it's great to hear the poems. I encourage readers to go out and find Bert's books. A lot of them are published by Marsh Hawk.
Good number of them. I was one of the founding editors of Marsh Hawk Press.
Right. So they're out there. They're available.
The new one selected was done by Blazevox, Jeffrey Gatza.
Yeah, great. It's a very nice, large format.
Good.
Yeah. But you've done this work as an editor, which I think is also very generous and important. And you started off with a book on Bronk, I think, and then did the Basil King, and then most recently.
Well, the Bronk book was many, many decades ago. The Basil King book was just a few years ago, yes.
And then you did the book with Quasha. So that's that's unselfish work. And how do you see that fitting into your whole overall work endeavors as a poet?
Well, there are two answers to that, and I'm not sure which one is the old, if you could choose. One is, as you know, because you and I work together, if you publish, we're at a research university, and if you publish, you get money, you get things, and so that's, I consider that, like Trollope said, who wrote so many books, so many novels, for him, he said that writing was like making shoes. You get up every day, instead of going to the workbench to make the shoes, you go to your podium. He wrote standing up at a podium, and he wrote a certain number of words every day, and it was just work a day. You got to make a living. But it's not to say that I'm fascinated by people I've written about or edited books where others are writing about somebody. And also, sometimes I do feel, for instance, the recent book on George Quasha, Zero Point Poesis, that's, to me, that's really, and I know you share this, Chris, to me, that's like really important when somebody's doing such singular work that is often brilliant, that people need to be exposed to it. What happens is usually people go to something like the lowest common denominator often, and I just find most of the poetry written, contemporary poetry, it just doesn't hold my attention. I don't see much in it. Whereas somebody like Quasha, who is difficult, it's kind of like Charles Bernstein's book, The Attack of the Difficult Poems. I mean, who said poetry was supposed to be easy? But there's something there. It's not BS. So I do feel that I do feel enthused about working on a book like that.
Yeah, great contributions. I mean, thank you. For us, for anyone who wants almost a expanded introduction to the work, and that's true for the, you've been connected with King Basil for a long time, so what better than to have a knowledgeable interpersonal
Well, it's nice to work with friends and people from whom I learn, and also to be able to do something for them. Basil King, by the way, was the youngest student ever at Black Mountain College.
That's right.
And he and Martha King, were both they didn't really get together until they left Black Mountain in San Francisco. But, you know, they come out of this lineage. And I became so interested in visual, in art generally in my later years, although art was always around me as a kid. But it just, I didn't realize what it was going to mean in my life. And I thought Basil's work was wonderful, and I felt it should get more attention.
Yeah. Well, that's it's really good of you to do that. I know that it's a lot of work. You're a fastidious editor.
You think?
You've published a couple of my essays, yeah. And I'm aware of the back and forth on all this. And in your own book, The Visible at Dusk, is, you know, you touch on a lot of these interconnections and interests with visual art and writing.
Yes.
And whatnot.
Yeah, so it was an opportunity to write about art by itself rather than involved with poetry, which I liked.
You do well at it. And I encourage readers to find these books. And, you know, you know although Bert is an academic, I thought that The Visible at Dusk was extremely accessible and didn't have a lot of the trappings of academic writing. I mean, there's a few footnotes maybe, but not, you know, it's not something that was beyond the reach of someone who just wanted to have an enjoyable reading experience. So that's good. Let's leave it at that, Bert, unless there's some last poem you want to read that needs to get out there.
I have no idea. I'll tell you what.
Yeah, go with that book. That's I love this
was
one.
My penultimate book. Is my penultimate book, and
we've been with Bert Kimmelman here on Poet Radio today, and who knows what's going to happen in 2023, but we will continue with the program in January.
Now I'm wondering if the book of the I don't know, I don't want to hold this up, so I'm grabbing a very short poem out of this book called Marriage. Okay? I hope I don't catch hell for this.
All right.
Okay. Marriage. Making love, sorrows and joys are one.
Very good. Thank you so much, Bert.
Great. Thank
to
you,
hear
Chris.
You
what and, a great opportunity.
Have a chance to pick your
and
mind.
An honor. Yeah.
All right, everybody. Be well. Catch you soon.